last leg of our year's journey together through the history of Western philosophy. Namely, 4 weeks dealing with about 200 years of empiricism, 19th and 20th century empiricism. And just to get the perspective, let's come back to this diagram, which you're familiar with, the intersection of modern empiricism and rationalism of the Enlightenment in the kind of synthesis effected by Immanuel Kant, out of which grew a distinction between two methodologies that have persisted in philosophy to this day. The rationalism of the Enlightenment was mainly on the European continent, Descartes, Spinoza, Leibniz. And the outgrowth of that, as we've seen in Hegel, the existential tradition, to some extent people like Whitehead, but the outcome, a phenomenological kind of method that tries to look at reality through the lens of the human self-awareness. Now, that phenomenological method continues today, as we were seeing last week, to dominate European thought, Western European thought on the continent. On the other hand, the empiricist tradition, Locke, Berkeley, and Hume, is mainly in Britain and continued in the 19th century with the three people we're going to be looking at, Auguste Comte, John Stuart Mill, and Ernst Mach. And the greatest of these is Ernst Mach. No, take it back. The greatest of these is John Stuart Mill. Sorry, the last of them, Ernst Mach. John Stuart Mill is the one to emphasize. But that continuing empiricist approach led to an emphasis on scientific method being universalized for all kinds of human knowledge. Now, whereas then the way of seeing the world, the lens through which everything was seen for the European tradition, is the human spirit with its creative freedom. And I think that's a fair generalization, whether you're talking of Hegel or of Sartre or of Dewey, you see. On the other hand, the lens through which the 19th century empiricists are seeing everything is simply the lens of nature as viewed through the scientific method. And so... The ways part. Now, to this day, throughout the 20th century, it's fair to say that the dominance, the philosophical dominance in the continent of Europe is phenomenological. Whereas the philosophical dominance in English-speaking philosophy is empiricist. And while perhaps not as imperialistic about scientific methodology, as it was in Mill and the early 20th century. Still a pretty strong theme that something like scientific criteria should be used in judging all human knowledge. So that's the distinction. There are attempts, obviously, to see comparisons between the two, to build bridges. I may have mentioned to you before that there was in the 1940s, the late 40s, a joint conference between English and French philosophers the proceedings of which were published in a volume called La Philosophie Analytique, Analytic Philosophy. And as you try to read it, you find that while the Frenchmen write in English, which is of help to many of us, and the English write in French, they pass like ships in the night, because they're just dealing with different things. Well, some 5 years ago, I was at a conference in Toronto, where there were European philosophers, more Dutch than French, and Anglo-Americans, dealing with the concept of rationality. Same experience, passing like ships in the night, you see. Simply because the methodology is different and the kinds of expectations are different. That's not to say that there are not some analytically oriented philosophers in European thought. There are, or that there are not some phenomenological thinkers in American thought, shall we say. There are. Most large departments try to have at least one representative, you know. We have one, Roberts, except that he has sort of wandered over into analytic thought, thanks to his work in Wittgenstein, as well as his work in Kierkegaard and Bultmann, you see. So the situation is there. Now, what I want to do today is to characterize 19th century empiricism, and we may have to continue with this on Monday, when we will be moving into 20th century. Next Monday we'll be moving into early 20th century with people like Bertrand Russell, George Ernest Moore, G.E. Moore. Okay. But for the characterization of 19th century, look at these three emphases. The extension of Enlightenment objectivity into, and I've written the hypothetico-deductive method, perhaps to make it a little more clear, into a hypothetico-deductive method. That is to say, a methodology applicable to science in the spirit of Enlightenment objectivity, rejecting the Kantian kind of Copernican revolution. Now, what do I mean by a hypothetico-deductive method, that phrase? You'll find it becomes increasingly familiar. But the previous Enlightenment thought in these 18th century empiricists had, of course, premises that are empirical generalizations, and from that, deductive inferences. And if we're talking about the continental rationalists, like Descartes, Spinoza, then what you have is some sort of intuitive, self-evident, innate, a priori premises and deductive method. In other words, The methodology of Enlightenment thought was from premises via deduction to logical conclusion, either a priori or empirical premises. Then 19 innate ideas and so forth are questionable. That empirical generalizations are awfully hard to verify. You can falsify them, but verifying them is empirically pretty difficult, and you've got the problem of induction. So instead of empirical generalizations or a priori premises, the emphasis is on a hypothesis as the premise. So from an empirical hypothesis, if this is true, what follows? Hypothetico-deductive. So a hypothesis for the premise, leading to deductive methods. Now, this is much more in keeping with actual scientific method. Remember, one of the criticisms of Francis Bacon and his inductive methods was that he gave no room to the use of hypotheses. Experimental methods, but without hypotheses. Well, here you see is a more mature approach, 19th century, and the hypothetico-deductive method. This becomes the understanding of scientific method in John Stuart Mill, in Ernst Mach, in Bertrand Russell, in 20th century logical positivism. In fact, it really wasn't cracked until Thomas Kuhn's book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, when it was recognized that science works more with paradigms than with hypotheses. Okay? So keep that in mind. Now, the second characteristic, the extension of that method, the hypothetico-deductive, to the human sciences. Previously, the tendency had been to think simply of science as dealing with physics, astronomy. That's where it started. Chemistry came into the game. Biology, gradually. But the significant thing in the 19th century is the extension of these kinds of methods to the human sciences, that is to say, to psychology, to sociology, to politics. The attempt also to apply it to ethics, so that ethics could become an empirical science. That's precisely what John Stuart Mill was after in his utilitarianism. He wanted to have an empirical scientific ethic. Yes, sir. So the extension of that scientific method to the human knowledge, the natural sciences of the social sciences, this becomes known in some quarters as scientism. Scientism. That science and science alone yields reliable knowledge. Scientism. And of course, our continental friends, meantime, would have conniptions over this sort of thing. What about the human spirit? What about the phenomenological method? And so forth. In fact, you might think of Husserl's attempt to deal with what he called the crisis in the sciences in the light of this. He wants to make philosophy into a rigorous science, but not with a hypothetical method. You see, with a priori principles derived by the phenomenological method. So then, these things. There's a consequence. And the consequence of this extension of scientific method to global range is the development of phenomenalism, anti-realism, anti-metaphysics. Yeah, phenomenalism, all we know is phenomena, things as they appear to us. What nowadays we call anti-realism, we don't know knowledge of ultimate reality as it is in itself. And the way it comes out, particularly in the 19th century, is a rejection of metaphysics. And I think that's particularly significant in the 19th century, because the nature of metaphysics, you see, was viewed in terms of the phenomena-noumena distinction. Viewed, if you like, in the light of the representational theory of knowledge, which left you with a lot of unanswered questions about the reality that it's supposed to represent. It's noticeable that people like Bradley, their works on metaphysics bear the titles like Appearance and Reality. That was Bradley's title, Appearance and Reality. Now, essentially, what the positivist movement is doing is saying all we know are the appearances, ruling out the reality. Notice that as you read John Stuart Mill. If you're interested in the question about mind and body, what is mind? Says Mill, mind is just the permanent possibility of reflections. Ideas of reflection. Now, mind isn't a thing. We don't know anything about its reality. What we mean by the word mind is, well, that which presumably is involved with further experience in the future, the permanent possibility of reflections. But what's matter? Permanent possibility of sensations. You say, that's not what matter is, it's what matter does. Well, phenomena, that's what it is for us. Yes, sir. So a thoroughgoing phenomenalist view develops in Comte, Mill, Mach, Bertrand Russell, yes and no, depending which decade of Bertrand Russell's career you're reading. He reserved the human person's right to change his mind and did it quite successfully at times. So that's the characterization. Now, how does this come out in these individuals? Well, first of all, Auguste Comte, Frenchman. Died in 1857. You have a chapter about Comte in Stumpf. And you have some selections in Gardner's anthology. You'll find Comte easy to get a hold of, easy to read. Watch for two things. One is his law of three stages. The other is his contention about the unity of science. Now, the law of three stages is his formulation of an empirical generalization about the history of science. He's an empiricist. And he's interested in the history of science. So he's going to give you an empirical generalization about the history of science. Namely, that science evolves through three stages. From a religious stage to a speculative stage to a scientific stage. Now, the religious stage, of course, produces theology, mythology, and so forth. Fictions. Imaginative fictions. Like The Divine Right of Kings, over which Charles I lost his head, you remember. Or fetishes in primitive animism. Notions of divine providence. This is the imaginative childhood of the human mind. The second stage is the speculative. Dealing with abstract ideas, constructs, metaphysical constructs, like theories of universals and essences, natural law ethics and jurisprudence, theories of natural rights, democratic ideals like all men are born equal, which are hardly empirical generalizations, notions of teleology, alchemy, astrology, final causes. You see, all these involve speculative theories about hidden realities. This is the adolescence of the human mind. But the third stage is empirical, scientific, dealing with what is positively known, what we can positively assert, hence the term positivism. What can be positively asserted, certain. This is the maturity, the adulthood of the human mind. And it's here in the scientific stage, then, that what we try to do is to formulate general covering laws. A general covering law is an empirical generalization that covers all the data. General covering laws. And it's on the basis of those general laws, generalizations, that you can make your predictions. And therefore, develop technology to make use of natural processes. The positive stage then is that to which the sciences are evolving. Now, he tries to trace the various sciences in this way. Religion has evolved to the metaphysical stage. A lot of theology is simply metaphysics. Chemistry has evolved, of course, from primitive fetishism through alchemy to science, empirical science. But what he is particularly anxious to see develop is a science of social change. A science of social change. After all, he's living in the first half of the 19th century in France, and if you're familiar with French history, it was an age of upheavals. So we want a science, an empirical science, of social change. And this is the beginning of what now has become sociology. Soc majors, if you look into the history of your science, you'll find this is the way it began. There was another man, roughly contemporary, a little bit older with Auguste Comte, a man named Saint-Simon. Sociology began in an attempt to be thoroughly empirical. And it's only in very recent years, matters of a decade or two, that sociology has begun to incorporate some of the phenomenological tradition and to recognize subjectivity and so forth, the influence of people like Max Weber. The unity of science is the second emphasis in Auguste Comte. Very simple. It's the notion that all of the sciences follow essentially the same method. All sciences follow essentially the same method. There's no differentiation between the study of nature and the study of human beings. The same method prevails for both. Ought to. And that thesis of the unity of the sciences is one of the things in Comte which has persisted into the 20th century, emphasis on the unity of the sciences. That's what Dewey is working with, where he tries to take the developed scientific method in reconstruction in philosophy and say this needs to be applied to social change, to handling social problems, to politics, to education, so on and so forth. Unity of the sciences. The differences between the sciences are differences of complexity. In that, sociology, for instance, has to build on psychology. Psychology has to build on biology. Biology has to build on chemistry. Chemistry has to build on physics. Physics has to build on mathematics. So there is a hierarchical arrangement of the sciences in terms of their complexity. And it's interesting that historically they have developed in that sequence, more and more complex. Well, that's my summary of Auguste Comte. Notice if you have the Gardner Anthology, did you bring it? I should have warned you. Notice on page 151, his comments about Descartes. Yeah, every French philosopher has to pay dues to the Descartes Union. And here's Comte's dues. While Descartes was rendering to the world the glorious service of instituting a complete system of positive philosophy, yes, what do you know for certain? The reformer, with all his bold energy, was unable to raise himself so far above his age as to give it complete logical extension by comprehending in it the part of physiology that relates to intellectual and moral phenomena. The part of physiology that relates to intellectual and moral phenomena. After having instituted a vast mechanical hypothesis upon the fundamental theory of the most simple and universal phenomena, he extended the same philosophical spirit to the different elementary notions, relations of the animal organism. But when he arrived at affections and the intellect, he stopped abruptly and constituted from them a special study as an appurtenance of metaphysico-theological philosophy. A word like that has to be something bad. To which he thus endeavored to give a new kind of life after having wrought far more successfully in sapping its scientific foundations. And on the next page, 152 at the bottom, what he's after, you see, is the positive theory of the affective and intellectual functions, which is this. It consists in the experimental and rational study of the phenomena of interior sense, ideas of reflection, proper to the cerebral ganglions, brain physiology, apart from all immediate external apparatus. He should have had a brain science. So what he's after is very plain, and you notice that by virtue of this extension of scientific method, he's advocating a methodological naturalism of the kind we met in John Dewey, right? Kind we met in John Dewey. I think this is why a professor of mine one time instituted a seminar by saying that, to his mind, positivism and pragmatism are both amount to the same thing and they're both dead-end streets. You see, because they confine themselves to the limitations of empirical science. Okay, questions? Comments? I think that's very simple and you probably grasp it right away. Okay. John Stuart Mill. I think it's fair to say that Mill is the most empirical of all the empiricists. You mean more than Locke and Hume? Yes. Hume, you see, talked of two kinds of knowledge. Matters of fact, relations of ideas. Relations of ideas are analytic truths, predicate contained in the subject, like mathematics. Mill maintains that mathematics is an empirical science. 3 + 5 = 8 is an empirical generalization about all sets of 3 and 5. So analytic truths then are really empirical generalizations, or if you like, empirical hypotheses. The laws of thought, non-contradiction, identity, A equals A and not non-A, empirical generalization about the way in which we think and use language. In other words, what Mill is doing is reducing these first principles to psychological generalizations. Generalizations, that is to say, about how the mind thinks. And this is what Husserl meant by psychologism, which he condemned. Psychologism does not provide an adequate foundation for mathematics, for logic, etc. You remember? Psychologism. So this is the sort of thing that Husserl was fighting against, that we anticipated there. But in this move, Mill is rejecting all intuitive knowledge, all innate knowledge, all self-evident truths. In fact, a considerable portion of his writing on epistemology was written in a work criticizing the philosophy of Sir William Hamilton, who was one of the Scottish realists. And, you know, Scottish realists in the tradition of Thomas Reid were talking of self-evident truths. Truths which we naturally, spontaneously come to believe by virtue of proclivities of the human mind built into the human constitution which God created. And what Mill is doing in the spirit of the Enlightenment is saying that's not certain enough, that's not positive enough. These are simply, these truths are simply empirical generalizations, empirical hypotheses, if you like. Now, to say that generalizations and self-evident truths are really hypotheses helps you to see how it is that Mill develops the hypothetico-deductive method. But it also helps you to see how he can be an empiricist and talk of the principles on which deduction work as being empirical. A syllogism, you see, not only has to have premises, but it has to have valid inferences, connections in accord with the laws of logic. But if the laws of logic are empirical generalizations and the premises are empirical generalizations, hypotheses, if you like, then you have really a syllogism as a manipulation of empirical knowledge. Simply that. Inductive reasoning, he recognizes, presupposes the uniformity of nature. Principle of induction. The uniformity of nature. Mill had pointed that out. Well, according to Mill, the uniformity of nature is simply our broadest empirical hypothesis. It's an empirical generalization extrapolated to everything. All right, that's the hypothesis. And thoroughly empirical procedure. In his work on logic, and Mill did a great deal of writing on logic, he refined Bacon's inductive methods. You remember his table of presence, table of absence, so forth. He refined those, essentially the same methods really, but a little closer definition, in order to render the kind of precision for positive knowledge that he wanted. Now, that then is how he approaches not only natural science, but the science of human nature. So, as I was saying just now, when he asks about the nature of matter, his response is very simply, that matter, that term, has as its meaning, empirical reference, its meaning, simply the permanent possibility of sensation. From an empirical standpoint, the existence of material bodies means that sensations are possible. And by the same token, the existence of mind means the permanent possibility of reflection. Well, you see, he's just building on the John Locke business, simple ideas of sensation, simple ideas of reflection. But discarding Locke's view of the reality of matter as substance, the substratum, and discarding Locke's view of the reality of mind or soul as immaterial substance, the thing that thinks, he's refusing to do metaphysics. Refusing to speculate. Notice that this is very close to David Hume, who called mind simply a bundle of perceptions. In fact, I think it's not quite as skeptical as David Hume. You see, when Hume said that all we know of mind is the bundle of perceptions, he was referring to our present perceptions, which include our memories that we think are of the past, anticipations we think are of the future. But for Hume, mind is simply this present bundle of perceptions. Beyond that present experience, we have no knowledge. No knowledge of matters of fact beyond present experience. This bundle of perceptions. Locke, of course, had asserted personal continuity, personal identity through memory, knowing the past, which Hume thinks isn't validated. May be true, we can't prove it. Mill, however, when he says permanent possibility, he's referring to the empirical generalization about matter or mind as being hypotheses. You see, if there is a permanent possibility of sensation, if there is a permanent possibility of reflection, then it's more than simply the present bundle of perceptions. There's personal continuity. At least, continuity of consciousness. So, he's refusing to do metaphysics. You might play with the relationship between this and Jean-Paul Sartre. No transcendental ego. Each new perception taken for me creates the self anew. You see? It's as if he's saying that the self is simply a permanent possibility of new reflections, of new for me experiences. So, what we have is roughly this same outcome in English philosophy in the 19th century that Sartre comes to in continental thought in the 20th century. You see, the dissolution of the self. Really. The dissolution of the self. Now, this is why the ethic that Mill develops, his utilitarian ethic, faces problem that is so often hurled at it. The utility principle, of course, says that we should maximize the pleasure and minimize the pain for the maximum number of people. It's saying you should treat people as a collection of painful and pleasurable experiences. But what else can you do if you're Mill? If the self is just the permanent possibility of experiences. All you can do ethically is to regard the self that way. And try to maximize the good experiences. There is no basis in utilitarianism for respect for persons. In the Kant tradition. For the simple reason, he has no conception of the person beyond simply the bundle of experiences. You see? Justice. Human rights. These are words we give to certain useful things which produce the positive experiences. So we value justice for its utility, not because it's right. There is no prior right, because there's no concept of persons with intrinsic rights. This is why John Stuart Mill has to develop a utilitarian theory of punishment, where previously punishment had been viewed in the retributivist sense. Incidentally, retributive punishment is not vengeance, revenge. No, that's a psychological process. Retribution is simply holding a person accountable. Holding a person responsible. And as it were, trying to maintain the balance within society. Something which doesn't belong to him. It's an attempt, in that word, at a social balancing of payments. Well, that's a notion which Mill would have no basis for. And so he developed a utilitarian theory of punishment building on Jeremy Bentham's Principles of Morality and Legislation, in which Bentham advocated providing punishment in order to reform the offender, to deter the offender, without holding the offender morally guilty in the classic sense. And so to this day you find really there are two theories of punishment, at least two theories of punishment, in our society. One, the retributivist, the other, the utilitarian. Sometimes combinations of the two. A retributivist theory was articulated by Kant, articulated by Aquinas, but with a teleology involved. There's a purpose in punishment. A redemptive purpose, hopefully. You see. In our society, these are the two, and by and large, our penal institutions seem to operate on a utilitarian theory of punishment. There was, a few years ago, development in Britain, which, building on a utilitarian ethic, advocated a therapeutic theory of punishment. That is to say, don't call it punishment at all, call it therapy. The idea being that the criminal is emotionally disturbed, socially maladjusted, so that what is needed is some kind of psychological therapy. And that created quite a stir because it seemed to minimize individual responsibility even more. You may be aware that C.S. Lewis has an article on that in the collection called God in the Dock, an article called The Humanitarian Theory of Punishment, because that was called the humanitarian theory. And his argument is that it just dehumanizes the person. It's not treating an individual as a person who did something, but as a cog in an environmental machine who didn't have any choice. You see? So the philosophical issue of freedom and determinism becomes very acute in that context. Well, Mill addresses the question of freedom and determinism, liberty and necessity. He, being anti-metaphysical, he has to reject necessitarianism. What he calls necessitarianism, sometimes nowadays called hard determinism. That is to say, there are sufficient causes for every human decision and action, such that no other decision or action could have occurred. Necessitarianism. The antecedent causes are both necessary and sufficient. Now, that's a view of causation, which is a phenomenalist he couldn't hold. It would imply that we know what Hume called necessary connections. And he agreed with Hume that we don't. So what we have then is a rejection of necessitarianism. On the other hand, he isn't happy about libertarianism, nowadays usually called indeterminism. The view that human choices, the human will, is free and could choose other than it does. He doesn't like that. And he doesn't like it because of the constant conjunctions, Hume's term, the constant conjunctions we observe between motive and action, including act of will. That is to say, there are antecedent psychological factors which are necessary to the performance of any action. So there seems to be a constant conjunction between those antecedent factors and the action. We cannot say that they necessitate it. That's a metaphysical theory. We don't know that. So what he has is instead a kind of compatibilism, as it's sometimes called, or soft determinism. He wants to affirm that, yes, we do make decisions, we do make choices. In that sense, yes to will. A choice that's not constrained by external causes. But he denies that those choices are not constrained by... No, he denies that they're not due to internal causes. Well, and this, of course, this view here, this soft determinism, plainly feeds into his utilitarian ethic and so forth, because if it is the case that we respond to causal factors which on our general hypotheses will lead to pleasure or pain, then those factors to which we respond in making choices will influence accordingly, and a utilitarian approach is therefore the consequence. All right, his utilitarian ethics, Stumpf deals with that very adequately. He develops a theory of belief that's rather like the theory about liberty, that beliefs are not so much freely chosen as they are psychologically produced. Now, the roots of that are in Hume as well. Remember Hume's psychology of belief? Constant conjunctions accustom the mind to expecting certain things, or to thinking there is necessary connection. So he has a similar kind of psychology of belief to that of David Hume. Well, that's the picture in Mill, and you can see, I would hope quite clearly, the hypothetico-deductive method. Extended to the human sciences, yes, in talking about mind, in talking about liberty and necessity, in talking about ethics. You see? Yeah, you need your general hypotheses as premises if you're going to predict the pleasure-pain consequences of a certain action and do your utilitarian decisions. So the extension of it to the human science is pretty plain, and likewise the phenomenalism. Okay, Mill? I can't quite get it, Esther.
Like when you talk about his view led to disillusionment of self, because you're always having this possibility.
Yes.
When it will ever be actualized, it will always just be possibilities. Or what do you mean exactly by infinite possibility?
Okay. Don't confuse his use of the word possibility with that of an Aristotelian, where the possible is in the process of becoming an actual. You see? All he means by permanent possibility of sensations is that when we talk about chair, a desk, an ink marker, a human body, what we're saying is we think that such things are visible, tangible. You see? Notice the ending. Visible, tangible, audible, touchable. You see? That is to say, if there are such things as material bodies, then as long as there are, is the possibility of sense experiences. That's all. Now, whether you, ever have sense experiences of that particular sort, whether I ever see Esther again, you see, that's a contingent matter. But to say Esther's real, she's alive, bodily existence, is saying no more than she's a visible being. But matter in the sense of the Newtonian spatial occupant, that's something else. That's something we can't affirm. Now, similarly with mind. You see, when I talk about your mind, or when you talk about your mind, you are, in effect, saying that having a mind means that you will have all sorts of states of consciousness that you can reflect on. Now, whether you do or not depends on whether you stay awake long enough. That's a contingent matter. But to have a mind is to reflect. What is it that Descartes said? A thinking thing? You see? Now what Mill's doing is dropping off the thing and just keeping the thinking. So it's just that. avoiding the metaphysical hypothesis, sticking with the empirical hypothesis. Yeah, now that may sound a little bit strange, but if you are trying to talk of human beings in purely empirical terms, how else would you do it? Well, the only way you can talk of human beings is in terms of physical sense data and reflective data. You see? The bodily story told in terms of physical sense data, the inner mental story told in terms of reflective data. That's all the empirical input we have about human beings. Is that clear enough? Okay. Let me add just a comment or two about Ernst Mach. He died in 1916, an Austrian physicist. The two things that he's important for, two things. One is his sensationalism, as it's usually called. He wrote a book called The Analysis of Sensations, in which he said we can analyze every object of experience into the sense qualities that are observable. So he wants to do the same as Mill, to describe phenomenal objects, the objects of experience, in terms only of sense data. And in that sense, the world consists, our world, our scientific world, consists of nothing but sensations, sense qualities. No non-empirical metaphysical assertions are acceptable in science. The second thing that he's important for comes out in a book of his on the science of mechanics, where he insists that a scientific theory is simply an economical way of describing relations between sense data. Now, put those two things together, and you have first, the only thing science can talk about is sense data. Second, scientific theories, therefore, are just theories relating sense data. Okay? Theories relating sense data. Relationships are not given. Relationships between sense data. We structure the sense data in certain ways. So that the objects that science talks about are ideal objects, phenomenal objects that we have structured. Rather than objects as they are in themselves. Now, this view of science, then, both ways and Mill's, the view that becomes known as instrumentalism. Scientific theories are simply instruments for doing things of a practical nature rather than bits of knowledge about any kind of reality in itself. This is the classic anti-realist view of science. Well, these then are the three characteristics of 19th century empiricism. Keep those in mind, and we'll get back to them on Monday when we take a look at Bertrand Russell. Okay? You have the reading assignment for this week. You have the reading assignment for next week, except that I will add some more on Monday. Remember what I said, that on Wednesday we have a visitor who will be speaking to the class. So we'll see you then.